This book, Revelation, has been helpful for us, hasn't it? And particularly in regards to helping you to lift your mind out of the world that would dominate your week and lift your mind to focus on the big realities of life. That's what this book does for us week in, week out. It takes us somewhere. And really, that's one of our big goals as we meet together each weekend. It's actually to together look forward and look ahead at the reality of heaven that is coming for us. We're to long for it, and we're to let our longing and our understanding of it shape the way we live today. In Revelation chapter 19, there's a whole lot of hallelujahs. Did you notice that? There's like hallelujahs going on left, right, and center. And the hallelujahs are celebrating something. They're celebrating the moment when God's people get to step into heaven, get to step into what you might call the immediate presence of God. You know, experience Him face to face in fullness. But look at how that's described when we get to be with God on that final day. Look at how it's described there in verse 7. Let us rejoice and be glad and give Him glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come. Heaven is described as a wedding that comes. And that's really helpful for us to dig into this symbol tonight. How does understanding that heaven is like the wedding of the Lamb, or a wedding generally, how does that help us understand and get our heads around what it's going to be like to be in heaven? There's a number of things I reckon you can draw from this symbol of a wedding to help us understand heaven, and one main thing that we're going to spend most of our time on tonight. But let me start with a few of the other things and then get to the main thing. Here's a few of the other things. When you think about heaven like a wedding or a marriage, it helps us understand this, that heaven and being with God is going to be amazing relationship and connection and intimacy. Yeah? Because that's the picture you get with a marriage or a wedding, being brought together, face-to-face relationship. Sometimes people can have a weird picture of what heaven's going to be like. Like you're going to be in this white dress, floating around on a fluffy cloud, kind of isolated a bit from people, maybe waving at them from a distance, and God's kind of somewhere around the place. No. Heaven is actually going to be drawing near to God face-to-face, like a husband and wife would do on their wedding day. Husband and wife come together, they make vows to each other, and the minute we step into God's presence, we step into the immediacy of His covenant love for us. We come across God and understand His commitment to us that will never fail. We will be exclusively His. He takes us as His own. He'll love us forever. Covenant faithfulness on us forever. When you get to Ephesians chapter 5, if you've reflected on that, it's instructions for husbands and wives about how to love each other. The way we're to know how to love each other is the way God, or the way Christ loved the church. And the way Christ loved the church is like a husband who actually, you know, it says in Ephesians 5, Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her like a bride. And that's how a husband is to love his wife. In the same way that God loves the church, His relationship with us is like a marriage. But not like our kind of broken, fallen, temporary marriages. His relationship with us as His people is this permanent, eternal marriage. And it's wonderful. The second thing I reckon you get from seeing that heaven is like a wedding or a marriage is this, is that heaven's going to be a place of amazing provision. So amazing relationship, amazing provision. Kind of like what you would get. Now, you read on in verse 9 there, and the wedding is described as though earlier we're the bride that gets married to the Lamb. You get down to verse 9, and we're the invited guests to the wedding. Have a look at verse 9. Then the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb, which is really a focus on the banquet, a focus on the feast, a focus on the celebration. And we get what that's like, don't we? Those of you who have ever been invited to a wedding reception. Most people, when they're putting on wedding receptions, their primary goal is to just lay it on thick, yeah? Bring out an abundance of provision so that everyone who is there enjoys their time with each other. They enjoy the food, they enjoy the wine, they enjoy the music, the dancing, and celebrating what's happened there. In fact, I reckon some of my most enjoyable moments in life have come during a feast that I've had with friends, or at a wedding reception where you're just sitting back and you're thinking, does it get any better than this? You know, like the lighting's right, the decor's right. I'm excited about what's just happened. This steak is incredible. The wine's unbelievable. You know, it's like you just have that moment where you're like, this is living. You know, this is the life. And you know what? If you've ever had a moment like that, whether it's at a wedding or not, that is just a glimpse of the incredible provision and enjoyment and celebration and satisfaction that we will have as we step into the presence of God. I'll tell you what, he knows how to put on a feast. Our banquets are one thing. Heaven's going to be another. It's going to be absolutely wonderful. So there you go. There's a couple of aspects. But there's one main one that I think is on view tonight with this whole wedding of the Lamb, wedding supper of the Lamb. And I think it's one of the most wonderful realities about heaven. And I'm wondering whether you're looking forward to it. And here's what it is. One of the best things about heaven will be when we are finally free from temptation. Finally free from temptation, because when heaven begins, temptation comes to an end. And when I say temptation, I mean temptation to sin. The desire to go after things God doesn't like. The desires to kind of love everything else in life but God. And the opportunity to kind of keep drifting away from God and keep walking away from God. That temptation will come to an end. How good would that day be? And you know what? You'll only get excited about temptation come to an end if you're living in the reality of the struggle right now. And you know, I actually reckon as we grow up in our faith and grow more mature in our faith, we'll become more aware of our sin and what we need to repent of, and more aware of the struggle, and we'll be more desperate for it to end. So tonight, as we look at heaven that is ahead of us and we think about the wedding that is to come, I want to focus on one particular aspect, how wonderful it will be when temptation to walk away from God, temptation to go after everything else but Him, temptation to sin finally comes to an end. Now, we know that temptation is going to come to an end on that final day, because at the very same moment that everyone here is singing hallelujah, the wedding now starts. At that very same moment the wedding begins, the great prostitute named Babylon gets taken down. And everyone's singing hallelujah about that as well. Now, if you're kind of new to Revelation, you're just visiting with us tonight and you're thinking, did he just say that? That's what we're looking at in these chapters in 17, 18, 19. We've got this prostitute named Babylon. She's all dolled up with jewelry. She's riding on the back of a big black beast with 7 heads and 10 crowns, and she's getting the whole world drunk on the filth of her adulteries. Welcome to Revelation. We've got some pretty wild stuff going on in these chapters. It's pretty strange imagery. However, as with the rest of the book, once you understand the symbolism, you see it's very helpful. So let's just spend a minute understanding the symbolism and then dig into how helpful it is. This prostitute's name is Babylon. Flick back to chapter 17, verse 5 with me. You see the name, chapter 17, verse 5, the name that's written on her forehead is Babylon the Great. She's the mother of all prostitutes. Now, why is her name Babylon? Well, look at verse 18 in that chapter, 17. Verse 18, right at the end there, where a number of these symbols actually get explained. Verse 18 says, "The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." So she's called Babylon because she is the great city, or she is a symbol of the great city Babylon. So what is Babylon? And why is it so good when Babylon falls? Babylon's been mentioned a couple of times already in the book of Revelation. You get it in chapter 14 and in chapter 16. So maybe you've already spent time understanding what Babylon means. But for those of you who haven't, let me just briefly explain Babylon. The first time we hear about the concept of the city Babylon in the Bible is back in Genesis chapter 11, when we have human men and women gathering together in proud opposition against God, and they're building the Tower of Babel. Okay, that's the first time we hear about Babylon. God had given a very clear instruction to humanity: spread out over the earth. And they hear that and go, nah, what we're going to do is we're going to stay here. We're going to make a name for ourselves. We're going to build something epic, like a tower. And we're going to build it up into the heavens symbolically to kind of say, we're epic. We're self-sufficient. And in arrogance, basically say, we are God ourselves. And that theme of humanity uniting in proud opposition to God and disobedience to God is a theme that continues for the city of Babylon through history. So as the years tick by, we see Babylon being featured as a city that actually becomes a bit of a superpower in the ancient world, but is a great threat to God's people, Israel, who are living in the promised land, and particularly a threat because Israel are trying to live under God, and Babylon, this huge superpower, are wanting to encourage everybody to oppose God. And Babylon, with their great wealth and power, end up attempting, continue to seduce God's people in this way. The word keeps getting put on Israel. Come into relationship with us. Come under our wing of protection. Worship our gods, not Yahweh. And trust in the security of our wealth and our power. Come to us. And so Babylon was always trying to seduce God's people. And so in that way, we're a great threat to God's people attempting to live under him. Now, when Babylon, the city, actually fell and the next superpower rose up, Assyria, the name Babylon continued to be used as somewhat of a metaphor or a way of referring to a great city or a great group of people who were united together in opposition to God, whether it be direct opposition or just subtle opposition because they're proud and arrogant in their own wealth. The name Babylon was always used to describe that kind of nation or that group of people, or that kind of world order. So in the first century, when this book, Revelation, is first read, in the first century, and there's mention of Babylon, it's likely the Christians in the first century thought immediately about the Roman Empire. They would have said, yeah, there's Babylon, the Roman Empire. But then right through history, there's been many Babylons. You know, there's been many groups of people gathering together with their wealth and power and not wanting to have anything to do with God. Today, what is Babylon? Well, there's lots of theories. It could be one great nation. I think likely we could understand Babylon today to simply be worldly culture. Yeah, the world that we live in, where people are proud and arrogant and often powerful and wealthy and think they don't need God. So it's kind of the world we live in. You know, the groups of people that we move around. And particularly, the world that we live in is a threat to God's people. We live in Babylon, basically. We're surrounded by Babylon and its culture. Now, the helpful thing about Babylon, the city, being described as a prostitute here is this. As we understand the temptation to sin, it might be easy to first think, oh yeah, running off after obviously evil things. Why would we ever want to do that? That's terrible. But as Babylon is described as a prostitute here, what we understand is this, is we're going to be tempted and seduced by Babylon because Babylon is very attractive to Christians. Like a prostitute, like in verse chapter 17, is all dolled up, you know, dressed in scarlet and purple and glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls. Like a prostitute is attractive and desirable, and attempts to seduce men. In that same way, this world we live in glitters. And it's very attractive to us. It's alluring to us. It's seductive to us. It's tempting us to go after it and its things and to leave God behind. And in that way, this world, Babylon, it's described as, you know, as the prostitute that's intoxicating the world with the wine of her adulteries, which is to basically just betray God and go after everything else. And you know, the truth is, we're pretty easily impressed by this world that we live in. We're pretty easily swept off our feet by the things of this world. We get impressed by mankind's things, you know. And the power of temptation is the prospect that it, the world and its things, will make us happier, but sin never makes us happier as we go off after it. The prostitute, Babylon, we're described here in verse 2 as the one that's corrupting the world with her adulteries. The ultimate corruption of the world is just humanity led away from its God. And this is the world we live in. Now, I've just been using some language there, like I've just been talking about the world or this world that we live in. And maybe some of you are sitting there thinking, this world that we live in is not all bad, is it? No, there are many good and wonderful things in this world. But we do need to understand that the Bible continually uses this language of this world to talk about the realm of humanity that lives without any need for God, lives in proud opposition to Him. And so this language of the world is used right through Scripture. It's everywhere. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, I'm going to mention a bunch of verses here. If you've got a pen, you can scribble some of these down. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, when Paul is speaking about Satan, he speaks about Satan as the one who is the god of this world. Now, we know our God is the ultimate sovereign God over the world, but Paul says, no, Satan has actually incredible influence on this world. And so here he's described as the god of this world who blinds the minds of unbelievers, this world. You get to 1 John chapter 2, and we're told that the world and its desires are passing away. Its desires likely in regards to desires for wealth and power, which leads to proud, arrogant self-sufficiency, which is opposition to God. Galatians chapter 1, is that this world is described as this present evil age that we live in. And so the instruction is very clear, do not love this world. Do not love the things of this world. Jesus says in John chapter 15, I chose you out of this world. We looked last week that Christians are those who have been redeemed from the earth. Romans chapter 12, do not conform to the pattern of this world. And James chapter 4, verse 4, this one's a cracker. Speaking to Christians, James says this, you adulterous people, you know, spiritually adulterous. Do you not know that friendship with the world is hatred towards God? When you become a friend with this world, you become an enemy of God. That's very strong language that's used to help us understand the world that we live in, the world of humanity united but opposed to God. Some of them subtly, some of them obviously, but we need to understand we live in the world. So friends, we live in Babylon. Now the good news is one day Babylon's going to fall. On the final day, when the wedding supper of the Lamb begins, that's the day where Babylon falls and the woman is brought to ruin and this world goes down. And that's actually a wonderful thing because that will be the day temptation to go after this world will come to an end. However, because that day has not yet come, Jesus has died on the cross and won a victory and we can be freed from slavery. But that final day where Babylon goes down and this world opposed to God gets taken out, because that day has not yet come, what that means is we live in the time where Babylon still stands and the woman still roams. And so today is the day of temptation. That's the day we live in. This side of heaven, that wedding, the struggle is real. And we need to acknowledge the struggle. We're easily lured away from our God. We're easily impressed by human achievement. We're going to struggle to not love the world. And so it calls for wisdom. We need to stay alert. We need to be discerning. We need to live very carefully. In fact, understanding these days as the days of temptation will mean we live very carefully. That understanding will impact and shape the way you live if you see it that way. So you get to chapter 18, verse 4, and the call for God's people is very clear. Then I heard another voice from heaven say, come out from her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins. Come out from her. Today's the day to leave Babylon. Today's the day to run from the prostitute. Today is the day to resist temptation. let's spend a little bit of time now thinking about what that might mean, because, you know, the New Testament is just chockers full of instructions about how we should be resisting temptation. And if this is the day we live in, we need to focus on making sure that's exactly what we do. We resist temptation. So I've got a couple of things for you here. I think I've got three, maybe four. We'll see how we go. The first thing, how to resist temptation. First thing I'll say is this. Know what it is about Babylon you find most attractive. Yeah? So know yourself and your weaknesses. James chapter 1 verse 13 says, temptation comes when we get dragged away by our own desires. That's how temptation comes upon you. It's not simply the circumstance you're in. It's not simply a powerful influence on you. You know where temptation comes from? It's when your own desires get triggered. That's where it comes from. You're tempted there in the heart with desires and longings for things of this world. So what is it in this world that you're most easily seduced by? You need to know yourself. What's your thing? What's your thing that you know gets you most excited? What's your thing that you know you get most devastated by when it's taken away? Now, here's the thing. It may be something obviously evil, yeah? But it's likely that if we're going to be seduced, it's likely more so that it's going to be Babylon or the prostitute here seducing us and luring us away to love good things too much. It's not necessarily, obviously we need to avoid obviously evil and sinful things, but chances are the way we're going to be lured is we're going to be encouraged and swayed to love the good things that God gives, but to love them too much, to make too much of them, to focus on them so much so that they become ultimate in your life. And when any good thing becomes an ultimate thing, you're heading down the path towards replacing God with some of his stuff, which is ultimate opposition towards God and ultimately offensive to him. We need to be very careful about the good things that can become ultimate. So what are the good things in this life, in this world, that you're tempted to make too much of? What's your weakness? Is it finances and money and the feeling of security that can come when you get it? Is it marriage and family and the feeling of significance that can come when you get that? Now, marriage and family, that is a good thing. But yes, it is entirely possible for your marriage and your family for you to love it too much so that it becomes ultimate and God just gets put on the back burner and he keeps getting put out onto the peripheral until all of your decisions in life are just made entirely based on your family and your marriage, and you can make it an idol. It's called familyolatry. And many Christians commit familyolatry because family just sounds so Christian. And God gave it to us as a good institution. Temporary, but a good institution for life here. But you can worship a good thing. What's your thing? Is your thing just the sweet, cruisy lifestyle that gives you the feeling of living the dream? And that's really what you're going after. And when you get a sniff of that, you're like, yes. And when that gets taken away from you, you're freaking out because that's what you're going for. Is it that you want to be a well-traveled person? Because you just really want that feeling of experiencing the world. I mean, these are all good things, but geez, they can become ultimate. The minute they become ultimate, they become an idol and they displace God and replace him. Remember when Jesus tells the parable of the soils? I think most of us are likely going to be most in danger of being the third soil. Yeah? If you've been a Christian for a little while, chances are your biggest temptation will be to be the third soil. The third soil is the thorny soil. It's the soil where the gospel seed goes in and the gospel seed is growing up in your life, but along with the gospel seed growing up is thorns. And those thorns are described as, in that parable, the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth. That's how the thorns are described. They're Babylon in your life. Just the things of life that crowd you out, consume your thinking, occupy your heart, and in the end, choke out the gospel seed in your life so that you drift from God. I've seen it. If you've been around for a little while, you've seen it happen to people. Don't let that happen to you. Today is the day to resist temptation. Today is the day to hack away the thorns. Today is the day to resist Babylon and run. So what decisions are you just about to make now? Small ones, big ones. What do you think? We're all making decisions. What decisions are you making right now? And have you thought about how that's likely going to impact the next 6 months or a year? Have you thought about what kind of a track or a path that may put you on? And are you sure that that path is going to be a path where you grow spiritually? Or could it possibly be that that path is a dodgy one where it's more likely that you'll struggle spiritually? You know, you ultimately show what's most valuable to you when you make decisions about what you do with your time and your money and where you live and everything, what you do with your kids. That's when you show what you really love. So what are you doing with your decisions right now? Are you on the verge of making a decision that's actually a compromise that's going to lead you deeper into Babylon and away from God? There's the first thing. Know yourself. Know your weakness. Know what is most alluring to you about Babylon. Just be honest about yourself. It's going to be different from the person next to you. What's yours? Once you've got some understanding about there, then we're just told to basically ask God for help. Yeah, so here's the second thing. Pray and ask God for help, trusting that He will help you to resist temptation. Yeah? Jesus, in the Lord's Prayer, which is a prayer He teaches us to pray, says, pray, lead me not into temptation, which is, Lord, you know, protect me from temptation. I'm susceptible to it. Deliver me from evil. When Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane on the night before He goes to the cross, he says to the disciples, pray that you will not fall into temptation, because the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Yeah? Can you acknowledge your flesh is weak? And can you cry out to God for help? That He would help you resist temptation and He would protect you. Pray to Him and trust that He is able to strengthen you. He's certainly powerfully able to help you. And one of the reasons why He's powerfully able to help you is because He was tempted. You know, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 18. Jesus was tempted in every way, but was without sin. And so He is able to help us when we are tempted. Who better to go to when you're struggling with temptation to sin than to the one who was tempted but resisted? Go to Him. He's going to help you. And maybe even right now as I'm talking to you, you let me keep talking, but you pray. You know what that temptation is that you need to pray about right now. You don't have to shut your eyes. You just start praying and ask Him for help. And trust this, you can resist. You can resist. No temptation. If you're a Christian, no temptation is going to come your way that you cannot resist. So 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. When you are tempted, He also provides for you a way out so you can endure. So as you sin and as you give in to temptation in the same area over and over again, whatever you do, don't start saying, oh, look, it's just me. I just can't resist temptation. No. You can. You can. Because if you're in Christ, you're actually now freed from the slavery to sin and you have His Spirit living in you. You now can resist temptation. So don't go putting that one on anyone else. That's on you. We can resist. Third thing. If you're aware of what's most tempting to you and you're praying about it, make sure you understand you're also responsible to take drastic action. Yeah? Take drastic action. Remember when we did 1 Timothy a couple of months back? We were told there to flee from sin, like literally run. When you see a temptation, you get your boots on and you run. And you wage war against sin. You might know Jesus' words in Matthew chapter 18 where he says, in regards to sin, if your hand causes you to sin, just be careful what you do with it sometimes. That's not what he says, does he? If your hand causes you to sin, you're joking, eh? Chop it off. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Now, that's extreme language, likely hyperbole, all right? But he uses hyperbole when he's trying to help us understand something that's very important, which is take drastic action against sin in your life. If there's temptation there, run from it. Don't muck around with it. Don't play with it. If your big struggle is lust, and you can't stop looking at pornography on your phone day in, day out, chuck your phone off the cliff and buy one of those little carny flip phones where all you can do is text and make calls. Chuck it. Come on. If your big thing is sport and leisure, ban yourself for a season. Self-imposed ban. Don't let anything get away on you. If your big thing is money and wealth and that's what's alluring to you, give your money away. Get rid of it. In fact, that's all of us. Get rid of your money. If your big thing is travel and it's got a hold of you and you cannot help thinking about all the... Rip up your passport. Rip it up. If your big thing is career and success and it just dominates everything you do in your life and your thinking, change jobs. Free up more of your time to serve your brothers and sisters and do kingdom things. If you're looking at your life and you know you're mixing with a certain kind of crowd that is influencing you and subtly causing you to move in a different direction, it's not just teenagers that suffer with peer pressure. We are all influenced by the people. If you notice the people you're now moving with are subtly changing what you're thinking and what you're doing, bail on them. Leave them. Don't be friends with them anymore. Now, some of you might say, oh, but that's a bit harsh. Who's going to be their Christian friend and who's going to be there to tell them about Jesus? Not you. Not you if you're just following them. If you're just being influenced by you, you're not doing them any good. So get out of there, get yourself straight, and then consider down the track going back in and trying to love them into Jesus. You're not doing them any good by just hanging around and being influenced by them. Take drastic action when you know that there's a sin you struggle with, when you know that there's a temptation that's always on your mind, when you know what that thing is in Babylon that's so alluring to you. And here's the final thing. It's the big theme of the passage we're looking at here. One of the best ways, or one of the key ways, to make sure we resist temptation is to actually just keep our eyes fixed on the wedding day. That's going to be one of the most helpful things you can do to actually stay away from Babylon, is keep your eyes fixed on the real deal. Heaven. You don't be seduced. Verse 7 there describes the bride, which is us. The wedding of the Lamb has come, and the bride has made herself ready. Fine linen, bright and clean, was given her to wear. Fine linen stands for the righteous acts of God's holy people. What matters in the end is that we're found dressed in this way, dressed in righteous acts, that we've kept ourselves for the wedding day. And because we've been so focused on that day. Let the reality of that day impact how you live right now so that you faithfully await the day, constantly anticipating the day. You got your eyes fixed on that day and there's nothing else bigger for you in your life than that day. Stay busy with the right things. I've told you a few stories about my nana before. I'll tell you one more and I'm sorry if I've told you before. My grandparents got married, had a one-week honeymoon, and then he went off to war. Cop that sweet. One-week honeymoon. You've been married for a week, and then your husband heads off to war. Now, as my grandma has reflected on that time, very challenging, it was a number of years before he actually did return, one of the blessed ones to be able to return from war. But as she reflects on that time, she does say that sadly, a number of her friends in a similar situation didn't stay faithful to their husbands while their husbands were away at war. And she says that with tears in her eyes, that they just didn't manage to pull that off and they went off after other men. But she didn't. And when I asked her, how did you stay faithful? What did you do? And she said, I busied myself. I busied myself with all the good things, Timmy. You know, she gave herself to the war effort, stitching blankets and getting stuff that gets sent over there, all the things. And she gave herself to church in a huge way. She just let it consume her and gave herself fully to. She stayed busy with good things. And that helped her stay faithful for him when he came back. The principle, the reason why I tell us, the principle there is, you know, we need to busy ourselves. Like we're all busy. Everyone's busy, right? How are you? Oh, busy. So busy. Yeah, with what? That's the question. Busy yourself with righteous acts. Not thinking that you're going to earn your salvation by those righteous acts, because that is what we wear as the bride, as we anticipate the day. Give yourself fully to the work of the Lord. Busy yourself with Jesus' things. Keep your head down in that direction. Because if you don't stay busy with the right things, all of us, with extra time up our sleeve, get up to no good. And you'll wander and you'll be tempted. So busy yourself with the right things. This wedding day that's coming for us, we've got to have our eyes fixed on it. And here God speaks to us through his word about that greater reality. It's revealed to us. We can't see it with our physical eyes, but we do see it with the eyes of faith. And we ought to focus on getting the clearest picture as we can on that day when it comes. And as we do, we will better see this world for what it is, Babylon. And we'll see that it's on its last legs. And it's soon going to go down. And when it goes down, it's going to go down fast. And as we acknowledge that reality, we'll even be even more determined to make sure we don't attach ourselves to a world that's going down. And we live very carefully, understanding we're easily impressed and enticed by this world. But she'll be dead tomorrow. But our Jesus, our loving Lord, will be alive forever, and we will be his bride. One of the best things about heaven is that it's the day when temptation is going to end. Bring that on. The day when we won't be lured away anymore, seduced by things that are just temporary and don't really bring joy. Look forward to that day, people. Have your eyes fixed on the wedding. And that day will be the day where we finally can fully give our devotion to him. 100% our affection directed towards him and him alone. Without any distraction and without any interruption, bring that day on. That is the day where we will rest with him and in him. But today is the day to fight and resist temptation. Let me pray.